Are we ready to start this? No is an
Yes.
acceptable answer. Okay. Good night, everyone.
I prefer not to.
I started researching this about an hour and a half ago.
I used Chat GPT. I'm not lying.
Oh no, I do not forgive you. Tell me about sloth. Okay. If we're coming to that, then we might as well let it write our podcasts for the for us.
I spoiler, it was unsatisfying.
Oh. That's why I use sexy AI. This is not an endorsement, it's an obsession.
I guess we have to start, huh?
Yeah. So
Okay.
as with me this week are my co-hosts. Well, okay, so this is the Dispatchist, a friendly, if torpid conversation about hell and some other stuff. Barely with me this week are my co-hosts Victoria and Jamin.
Five more minutes, Mom. 5 more minutes.
5 more minutes. And I am the cruel taskmaster of the evening, Jacob. This is episode 79 of the Dispatchist.
Wow.
Finding time for sloth.
I feel like we now have to snap out of sloth, or this is not going to go well.
Hit the snooze button.
We just shout at each other all the
Okay, I have I had some coffee, so I think I'll unslothify here pretty soon.
Okay.
I just wanted to take a moment because I don't recall if we've talked about the Gilligan theory.
The Gilligan theory. We have
The
not.
Gilligan theory.
You've
So
mentioned the Gilligan theory twice before.
we have talked about the
yes.
Kala Kansari. It
The Kalakansari.
has the same number of syllables.
Yes. So the Gilligan theory is that, and this is actually backed up by
Physics.
Sherwood Schwartz, who is the creator of Gilligan's Island,
Oh, okay.
that
Oh, no.
they
Each of the characters is
yes.
a deadly sin.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, so they kind of vary a little bit, but let me see if I recall. Okay, so Gilligan is supposed to be sloth, potentially. He could also be gluttony because he eats all the time.
Okay.
Of course, Mr. Howell is greed.
Okay.
Of course, Ginger is lust.
Because she's the pretty one.
Because she's a pretty one. She doesn't enact lust, but she's lusted after. The professor's pride. Who's the other pretty one who's not Ginger?
The
Mary
skipper.
Jane. Is it Marianne? Marianne. She is envy because there's an assumption that she's envious of Ginger.
Okay.
The skipper is wrath.
Huh.
And what do we have left? We have
Sloth, I
wrath,
think.
sloth. Well,
Is Sloth is Gilligan? No.
sloth could either be Mrs. Howell or Gilligan, as could gluttony, because she is all about material wealth and she brings like, months worth of luggage on a 3-hour tour.
Okay.
But she could also be, the skipper could also be gluttony. But then it's unclear who Wrath is. So I think the canonical understanding is what we have here. But there are other theories floated that they're in hell. And as you know, Gilligan always wears red. So ostensibly, he's the devil.
Oh, I Gilligan is
don't
the devil.
know. Because he just keeps them there. So he's kind of not, he's not the, powerful devil. He's more like the devil in Bedazzled, the original, both Bedazzles, where he's just kind of like thwarting everybody. So because it, even people say that even the theme song gives hints, essentially like they're never going to leave. They're here forever.
Is that
So
hell or syndication?
I think it's, maybe syndication is hell. I mean, Hogan's Heroes could be a Yeah, that's it could pretty much apply to anything. But
Okay.
supposedly Sherwood Schwartz has backed this up.
So I just read this. It's beautiful.
It's beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Gilligan is the devil. The greatest part of the metaphor is that if the others ever want to get off the island,
they have to kill Gilligan.
They have to kill Gilligan.
Ooh.
I love it.
It's like, and they're all just too kind to do so.
Yeah, well, since 70s TV, I mean, it's not going to really get that bloody. It's a sitcom.
So, yeah, I guess that was a very special episode that never showed up in syndication. So it ran from, how long did it run? Because it started out in black and white, and then it moved to color. It's terrible that I know that. I think that's true. Did it start in black and white? I feel like I have memories of it being in black and white, but maybe it was just because I watched it on black and white TV.
I did remember what I was reaching for a few seconds ago and forgot, and that was that I read an article or heard an article about why 7 is important. And there were a couple of different answers, one of them based on astronomy or something like that. But one of the most compelling ones was that it's the whole we have space in our minds for 7 ± 2 things. Mm. Yeah, that's, which is fairly true in terms of storing something in our short duration memory, which kind of trended towards the idea of 7 being like enough as a number, or like a big amount as a number.
Oh.
So that gave 7 like a sort of completion, or kind of the high end of like easy numbers. So
this is as high as I can count without using my fingers.
Right. So it just became kind of important, and a number that kind of felt like completion, which I kind of believe that as that kind of accretes over time.
Hmm. Okay. That's an interesting, I kind of like that. Oh, let's see. I was also looking up I meant to check out what are where we are with the Lantern Corps.
Mm-hmm. There is no sloth. That would be really
no. But go ahead.
No. I was just saying there is no sloth. That'd be really boring.
No.
And boring doesn't sell comics.
Light blue is supposed to be associated with sloth, and so that why I thought initially that blue would be, but blue is hope.
Yeah.
So that did not hold up. And also, do you want to guess what animal is associated with sloth?
Sloths.
Slugs.
I will tell you how sloths became associated with sloth, but it's one of my favorite animals, and it's not a crab, and it's not a Fig Newton.
It's certainly not a bee. Bees are not associated with sloth.
No, and they're technically not an animal.
Bees are not animals?
What do I like to wear all the time?
Clothes.
Pants.
Glasses. Hang on.
I like to eat cans.
Shirts that have the pogues on it.
Goats. Goats.
Yes,
goats are not sloths.
Goats are like the most industrious can eaters.
It's true. And they're just like total little jerks. So
yeah, also true.
It takes a lot of energy to be a jerk.
It does. No, I'm not seeing it at all.
No. But that's supposedly goats is just like the frog. What was it? Frogs with greed didn't make whole lot. We had a one D&D game. Our bag of holding was a frog. So we were just stuffing things into it.
That's kind of beautiful.
It was pretty great.
Well, did anybody bring anything to the party?
I did.
You did.
And in keeping with sloth, I have a bar GPT generated cocktail.
There's a bar GPT?
Yep. It will create cocktails for you.
I was hoping you'd do something to slow gin.
Oh, damn.
Oh.
My life is a lie.
Yeah, well, that's the end of this episode.
I'll just see myself out. No, so what I've got is Belphegor's Indulgence, the sloth cocktail. And I'm going to post a picture, the AI-generated picture.
Oh, he comes a picture. Life is so good.
It's a great picture, too. I know. I haven't been very good about giving you drink pictures.
I haven't been very good about using them in a few months. It's okay. Sloth is strong with this one.
Okay. So The sinfully delightful cocktail celebrating the essence of sloth. So,
that's lovely.
Isn't it? It looks delicious. So it is for those who revel in the leisure and pleasure of life. See, this is the other side of sloth. I'm encouraging you to slow down and savor every sip. It's a blend of rich, decadent flavors with a touch of effervescence, ensuring a luxurious drinking experience. So you serve it in an oversized snifter, as you can see. And there's like, I don't know if the little chocolate bubbles floating above, but it's aged rum, dark rum preferably, falernum. We've talked about falernum before. 1 ounce velvet falernum. And to just to remind ourselves what falernum is, it is a sweet syrupy liquor from the Barbados, and okay. It's used in zombies and etc. So oh no, where did I go? Okay. A coconut cream, which I would drink just yes. Buckets of coconut cream.
Well, you haven't lost me on this one yet.
No, it sounds delicious. Espresso, 3 dashes. Oh, sorry, I haven't been giving you the amounts. 2 ounces rum, 1 ounce velvet falernum, 1/2 ounce coconut cream, 1/2 ounce espresso, 3 dashes of chocolate bitters, a splash of sparkling water, and shaved dark chocolate and a sprig of mint. So you throw things in a shaker, shake vigorously for about 15 seconds.
Until you get bored.
Exactly. Till you just, you're laying on the ground. You actually, you have one of those, shake weights. drain the concoction into the chilled oversized snifter filled with crushed ice. You top it with some sparkling water. You garnish it and you serve with a short straw. I don't know why a short straw. But anywho, it sounds delicious. We may have to try to make that because I think it would be easy to do a non-alcoholic version.
The alcohol in there doesn't sound terribly bad. It's kind of syrupy.
No, yeah, the rum. Rum is pretty delicious.
Yeah.
So there we have it.
So I did bring some light entertainment.
Sure.
Having one's eyes turned into swarms of poisonous bat-maned beasts.
Bat maimed or like hurt or
I think it'd be like having a mane that is like that of a bat.
Do bats have manes?
Don't have.
No, I think they have spiky little things.
Some of them have kind of like little like pompadours.
Yeah, Elvis bats.
A bat pompadour.
They're not really majestic.
Oh, they try. They try so hard. I love bats.
But
that's pretty interesting.
Those are your eyes now.
Yeah.
I don't know why that's such a great phrase out of context. Those are your eyes now.
And they're over there somewhere.
I was using those to look at stuff.
Them's your eyes now.
Can we get a sticker made? Those are your eyes now. The Dispatch is 2024.
And it's just like crabs. It's kind of like the, is it the Venetian, but with crabs instead of teeth? And Sandman. Well,
I assume they fly.
Oh, your eyes fly?
Well, because they're a swarm.
They're a swarm, yeah.
Oh, that's right.
Terrestrial creatures don't swarm.
Children swarm.
Damn it. Children are creatures.
Yes, they are.
Are they though? Yes, it's the the Corinthian, sorry. Corinthian is the one that has eyes for teeth for eyes. Okay.
Yes, he does.
Now he has crabs for eyes.
I don't think so.
Okay, sorry.
Cancerization of the Corinthian?
That's right. Uh-huh. I like that. I don't have any news, but I thought maybe we should talk about leap day.
It's okay. Leap day.
Oh, it is, as we are recording.
Oh yes, today is leap day. This won't come out on leap day, but can I give you some fun facts about leap day?
Hello from the past.
Not more than 3.
Oh, don't worry. So do you know why we have leap day at the end of February? And not in December.
because Brutus Caesar murdered, Butter picked a pack of purple peppers.
Jeez Louise, we're off to a bad start.
No, it's because in many cultures in the Northern Hemisphere, the year begins in springtime in March and ends with the blight with winter in February.
Okay.
So there's that.
Oh, so we just put it at the end of the year, not the middle of the year.
Right. Yeah. So, and also when, unfortunately, a lot of the leap day traditions have to do with women being able to proposition men.
No, crazy. Once every 4 years.
Yes, crazy. And that has to do, like, it's attributed.
Calm down, Sadie Hawkins.
It's a standard inversion holiday thing.
And it's all like the story is that St. Bridget asked Patrick, like, hey, shouldn't women get a chance to do this? And he's like, sure. We'll make a day for that. Turns out it's kind of like February being Black History Month. Like, okay, you get one every 4 years. But this also means that in Greece, it's considered to be so unlucky that couples are discouraged from marrying on that date. And those who do are warned that they're going to divorce. And this superstition probably came from the Romans because they believed that February was the month of the dead. And so the extra day meant that one more day when Pluto or Hades could was free to walk the earth. So there you have it. Leap day. Does that change any of your feelings about it? Does anybody care?
I suddenly like want to meet somebody special and propose to them on leap day just to get out of anniversaries. How genius.
That doesn't work.
Here's the thing. So if a woman proposes to you and you say no, you have to buy her 12 pairs of gloves.
What?
Yeah, this is another rule.
Okay with that.
So if she proposes on leap day and during the Middle Ages.
That sounds like artificial intelligence generating holiday traditions.
Oh, no. I looked at several non AI sites that were definitely legit. On the money.
Okay.
Actually, some of them were. There was one in, I want to say, like Forbes or something. But
Forbes,
yeah,
the most trustworthy.
Forbes is pretty trustworthy.
Of Greco-Roman mythology.
Right, like it's a little weird. But yeah, during the Middle Ages, there were laws governing the tradition of the gloves. So, anywho, I couldn't find any news. I tried to find news on sloth, but
I found something. This is a bit dated. This is from 2016, and it's not really news. It's just kind of an article that I found amusing. It was called, it's about the 1855 Devil's Footprints in Devon, England. And I know Jaman, you like devil's track stories and things like that.
Yes!
So this was one where there was a series of footprints going in a up and down and over everything. They were little cloven footprints, but they were in a straight line. So the author of this article put a picture of Buer in the header, and I was so happy.
Oh. What?
Because he rolls in a straight line.
Yeah.
Oh, did you see the picture that I posted of the sloth version of Buer?
Yes. Where did that one come from?
That was another like early depiction of a sloth-like creature.
Weird. Mm-hmm. Strange.
Yep. Yeah, I think the whole hanging upside down kind of made the limbs, like as you're describing it to somebody who's never seen one before, that's how he wound up. Like, oh, it was this thing that was hanging upside down and his legs looked like this. And then he had a human face. So. Sloth.
Yeah, let's get to it.
Orpheus. So I kind of had one of those like I'm dumb moments.
Mm-hmm.
It was after Jacob yelled at me for being dumb.
Yeah.
Right. No. Yeah. So I was like,
I did not.
He and I were talking and I was like, is Slug named after Sluggish? Or is Sluggish named after the slug, right? And we kind of knew, it's like sloths are very new world. Nobody in the old world knew what a sloth was. So obviously the creature is named after the concept.
Yes, I think so.
Right. I mean, I say obviously mm-hmm. I did zero research on this. Mm-hmm. Maybe the Incans knew this all along. And so Slug the creature. And I went back looking, and they are pretty much the same word.
Mm.
And exactly. I came across, and I'll say this kind of, if you grow, you show growth. If you're warm, you show warmth. And lots of words, like long length, wide width, etc. If you're slow, you show sloth. It's the noun aspect of the verb. And I was like, oh, sloth is obviously from slow, which is the same word as slug.
Yeah.
And yeah, I knew that, but I hadn't seen that pattern of like wide width, where you add the TH to make it a noun.
Yeah.
And just a puzzle clicked.
Can we talk about real sloths for a moment?
Real sloths?
Because it does go into words.
Yeah.
Okay.
But just so you know, every minute we spend on this takes away from the time we can use to be discussing sloth versus diligence, kids objects lessons.
That's right.
Okay with that.
Do we want to, before we dive into sloths?
No.
Okay.
I'm just happy having said that.
Oh, yeah. We got to talk about that. That is very, very important. Okay. So, so there's this book that I started reading other chapters of when I should have been actually doing more research because I like natural history. And so this is a book, a chapter from a book called Sloth by Alan Rausch. And the chapter is The Sin of Sloth and the Sloths of Sin. So you can see why I wanted to read it. So
yes.
The term sloth dates back probably to about 1175 as the words, and remind me, a thorn is pronounced TH, right?
Yes, correct.
Okay, so it's a slough, like the word sloutha or slough. This, needless to say, was well before sloths, the animals, were introduced to the Western world. And that happened in 1535 when a Spanish colonialist and historian, Gonzalo Fernandez de Avedo, identified them with a sense of irony as swift parrots or periquitos lingueros. And so that drawing of the weird boar-like sloth was from his history.
Swift parrots?
Swift parrots.
Was he drunk?
He's a colonialist. So.
Deeply ironic.
Has he ever seen a parrot?
Well, the parrot is also a crab with a human face. So an English botanist and anatomist, Nehemiah Grew, was the first one who actually used the word sloth to name the animal, or sloth. And then we move on to the word sloth itself, meaning laziness, indifference, and ultimately being a sin, to Evagrius Ponticus, who we've talked about before. So there is a direct connection between the words, but also around the 12th century, acedia gave way to, again, to sloth with another thorn. The word for slow, and from it, the quality of sin that we call sloth. But also, groups of bears were called a sloth.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Sometimes of year, that's probably appropriate.
Yeah. So the first animals that we know as sloths were first called that by Samuel Purchas. And he wrote, the Spaniards called it the light dog, the Portugal sloth, the Indians hay. So at this point, it became the symbol of idleness and indolence once the colonialists named it. So here's where the author gets really weirdly angry. It's fascinating because he
takes it personally.
He does, because he insists on sloths being very action oriented creatures. And he takes umbrage at them being ascribed lazy traits. And he said, if we mistakenly impose the connotation of the term on the animal itself, we are imposing Western cultural and religious implications on creatures that are, of course, indifferent to human value judgments. And he talks about people trying to correct sloths. And it sounds a lot like the abuse of colonial subjects. So, he says, the unwillingness to accept the sloth on its own terms can be disturbing. For example, when Edward Bancroft in his Guyana Journal tries to correct the insufferable aversion to motion in sloths by beating them, which results in some movement, but only at the expense of the most melancholy, pitiful noises and grimaces.
Oh,
I know. But the thing is, like, he spends all this energy on how dare they call sloths lazy and they beat them to put them in. It's like, dude, you're talking about colonialism. You're talking about people. Like, this is what happened to people. But he's projected it onto a sloth. But he really cares about the sloths. He wrote a whole book on it.
So. Okay. Okay.
Sloths.
The most pitiful noises.
Excelsior.
I know. Poor little sloths. Oh,
Oh my gosh.
Again, this is valuable time taken away from kids' object lessons.
Which still, like, I swear, if we're to create a series of somebody doing a bad job creating object lessons about the sins, this is exactly what we would do.
But we wouldn't be we'd be insincere.
It's true. She's not sincere.
Okay, so this week's episode is Kids Object Lessons, Sloth versus Diligence. Mm-hmm. I have to say, first off, what do we make of Charlotte's haute couture?
I think she's...
the cat ears?
Cat ears, leopard print shirt. And you'll notice she left her price tags on her earpiece as like a classic mini Pearl maneuver.
I
wondered what that was.
Yeah.
I feel like, again, she wants to put this on her highlight reel. Like when she goes.
Just my sizzle reel.
Yes, exactly. Oh, her sizzle Lord. Reel. Because did you see how she was emoting?
Yes, I did actually. Mm-hmm. I noticed mm-hmm. that she was really like making the effort.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So this week's experiment, it was kind of dull, actually. We got a glass of water, and we got an empty glass, mm-hmm. three colors of food coloring, excluding green, mm-hmm. and it didn't look like anything was going to explode, and nothing exploded.
Yeah, nothing exploded.
Nothing exploded.
So to demonstrate, so sloth is a glass half full of cooking oil. I'd say probably vegetable oil, nothing too heavy. It'd be a lightweight oil with like not very flavorful.
But you forgot to say what the food coloring represented.
Your talents. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Of which you can only have three.
Well, no. Charlotte was a girl. Who's to say the boys couldn't have more talents?
Then maybe the girl, the boys get the green ones as well.
Leap year, she gets an extra.
Damn you, patriarchy.
Dice represent various skills. Charlotte takes a few drops of each dye and puts them in the bottom of this glass. Mm-hmm. And then Salvation Army lady surprises us by pulling out vegetable oil and pouring it about 3 inches in and stirring it up. So we get this kind of black color
murky thing
at the bottom.
She's a big fan of murky liquids.
Yeah. And this represents sloth.
Yes.
Do you buy that?
I was kind of like, I watched till the end and I kind of wanted you to explain this to me.
Well, and then you take diligence, which is tap water, and pour it in. And mm-hmm. in the proud tradition of all of these things, nothing happens.
And then what happened? Then there's a cut.
There's a cut of some sort. And towards the end, a very small amount of the dye is settling out of the suspension in the oil and mixing with the water very slowly, so it turns into pea color.
And in Charlotte's like finest moment of acting, she says, "That's so cool."
Yeah, you have to really emote to make this one seem cool. It is, I think it is the least interesting experiment because nothing happened. Like when she poured the water through the like oil and dye, it was just water.
Yeah, I was kind of like, I was expecting something to, I mean, I know how oil and water works. I don't know why I was expecting something.
Well, what would it have got? It would be brown, wouldn't it?
This is where I got confused. Well, there's a whole lot of confusion.
You're saying you made it this far?
Okay, so when Charlotte put the food coloring in the glass, the food coloring itself became a murky liquid.
Right.
Because it's not like it's kept separate, right? So you didn't have a separate blob of red, green, and yellow, or red, blue, and yellow, right?
Yeah.
So there's the colors.
Yeah.
So I'm still not sure like how each color then Did she expect them all to retain, like, oh, if you do it correctly, then there'll be red blobs and yellow blobs and blue blobs?
I just don't think it was thought out.
I don't either. Are they? Are they?
Have you
I
met
feel like, yeah.
Thunder Bay Church?
Oh, I don't know. Okay. So, yeah. So another well-intentioned yet failed experiment.
My takeaways from this were, number one, sloths really exist. Very keen on mentioning that. And number two, what sloth Barry's diligence pulls out and makes into a sort of pea color.
But also she had the gall to badmouth the sloth in Zootopia. Like, completely missing the point.
Yeah, no, her lack of perception confuses me from time to time.
I think she identifies with the bunny in Zootopia. I think that's what happened there.
Don't we all?
I think I identify with sloth.
Okay.
I don't know. I don't know. I have to think more about Zootopia, see what animal resonates with me.
So one of the challenges for talking about sloth is the challenge of defining it. I have a new theory, which is that every one of these sins has three layers. There's the what it obviously means, but what you can't accept as the basic meaning, which is lust is lust. Gluttony is about food. And sloth is about not getting out of bed ever. Mm-hmm. That's the surface failed meaning is obviously not right. The second level is the extended cinematic universe, spelled S-I-N. Nomadic. And that's when you start saying everything that sloth could mean.
Yes.
So sloth could mean indifference, neglect, being too busy, not being busy enough, apathy, falling out of love with God, etc., finding time for anything but God, depression, reluctance, fear, etc. So it's when you start listing everything it could possibly mean. And then level three is if you can't break even, you can't get out of the game, where everything is sloth and we cannot escape it. So that's kind of my current working model of what a deadly sin is. Like, it wasn't enough for what the Bible said, which is like not getting out of bed. You got to extend it into like all ramifications of life where you cannot escape it ever. And every one of these sins, someone has said, this is the most dangerous sin. But I think you can make a case for sloth, though, actually.
Of being the dangerous sin?
Yeah, yeah. We're dealing with one of the lowest levels of like the sins of the soul and the mind sort of thing. And consistently in like the level two definitions of sloth, it's things that keep you away from God. Mm-hmm. And as that sin is by definition, that which keeps you away from God. So sloth is kind of purely about like making you reluctant to approach God, making you deny the joy of whatever the hell God wants you to do this week.
Mm-hmm.
It's all about psychological distance from what God opportunities there are for you, including like despair at dealing with the idea of God, you know, looking upwards at the trail and the narrow path, or I assume just giving up on God because it's not a concept that works for you. Of course, it's only a sin if you buy into the idea of sin. So it doesn't really matter at that point. Mm-hmm. But it is kind of like all of these ideas that distance you from God kind of fall into the great bucket of like oil and food coloring mixed together that is sloth.
Oh, okay. So another thing, this is just going back, because I will connect these things. No. But going back to
ADHD is sloth.
The object. Yes.
Aww.
I feel like being a neuroatypical is sloth, essentially, or it's defined. Many of the things are connected, but I would say, so going back to our friend with the object lessons, she also said that, and I kind of agree with one aspect of this, that yes, it does seem like ignoring or not appreciating the bounty of God's goodness is a sin, ergo sloth is a sin. But did you remember that she said that God gives you food, clothing, and money?
I did catch that God gives you money, but she does go on to say, and bear in mind, Salvation Army, she goes on to say, these are things you can give away to make
That's true.
Better.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good point.
Right, 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 right. But I didn't catch that. It did make me jump a little bit.
So it is a weird, like, sloth in some ways may be, again, also, like, refusing, because that is a sort of sidecar for a lot of the other sins, is that you're also not appreciating the gifts that are given you.
Yeah.
And in many, and we can talk about this a little bit more later, but sloth also is kind of the anti-sin, where it prevents you from engaging in other sins. Yeah, you can't be acquisitive. You can't go, you can't enact, you know, act on lust. You can't be wrathful.
That's a level one sloth. And
yeah, that's true.
I think the only true sin that you cannot recover from is the sin of rejecting God. And that's kind of a tautology. Mm-hmm. But that fundamentally, the walking away or the avoidant attitude towards God is sloth at its core. Mm-hmm. So it is like the deadly sin that is the only one that you can't get away from. And in that way, maybe it is the greatest of the deadly sins.
But apostasy, like either sloth and there's apostasy.
Mm-hmm.
And apostasy is very active. You have to actively walk away, turn your back.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Whereas sloth is like, I'm just too lazy to get up and go to church today.
It's not that. It's a lot of things. It's depression and it's fear. And you don't watch BoJack Horseman ever, but there's this one scene.
I love BoJack Horseman. You do.
So that thing where Mr. Peanut Butter's philosophy of life, which is that it's about filling your time up with all sorts of senseless, busy things, and then someday you'll realize that, and then you die. And that's a form of sloth. It's mm-hmm. making your life too full to move towards God. It's a lot of like the level two definitions of sloth are about avoiding time with God, doing things that prevent you from building a relationship with God. Like it's sloth in the level two meanings is very specifically valenced towards things that prohibit you from clearing your mind, reflecting on God, taking joy in God's gifts to you, and like embracing God. And apostasy is like three out of four of those. Level two interpretations make me mad. I see your face.
I hear
German.
Everything you say.
It's frustrating. It's
frustratingly logical.
It is. That's the level two game. Is level one is I can't get off my sofa. And then the people will say, but that's not enough. You must understand. And mm-hmm. then by level three, you realize that we are all so deep in this that we're never going to be good. And that's actually probably enlightenment, because at that point, you know, we can all get ourselves out of the gutter together. Or join me in the gutter, either one.
So you touched on this because originally sadness was one of the sins.
Yes.
There was sadness and sloth.
Yes.
But then they, at one point.
And acedia was kind of in that mix as well.
Yeah. And then sadness was they kept switching places.
Right, right, right.
Sadness and sloth.
Those three mixed together like three colors of dye.
See, that would have been more interesting. So sadness, I mean, and this is where it gets confusing. There's a lot of stuff that's confusing because also Aquinas sort of goes back and forth over whether or not sloth is actually a sin, because sadness is not a sin because it's a sin of the spirit, but it acts on the body, because a lot of descriptions of sloth are kind of like vampirism or being the living dead. And
I hadn't gone there in my head, but I'm glad you did.
It's true. And then there's also the whole idea of suicide as being the greatest sin of all, like self-harm. If you know, going back to Inferno, you know, you have the forest of suicides and sloth, like that sadness aspect. Although Aquinas says it's spiritual, it actually is kind of the more physical aspect, right? Because it affects you. So it's a sin of self-harm in a lot of ways.
And someone suggested that, I mean, the aspects of fear and sorrow and sadness that are tied up in sloth tend to be kind of inward facing. Mm-hmm. Like, so they're not, it's not like mourning the death of a loved one. It's self-pity is also like one of the words that feeds into asceticism.
Asceticism.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. This is more mental health stuff, but these are like negative energies directed inwards that are preventing you from doing the thing. In all cases, sloth is the sin of not doing it.
There came that realization that, oh, just like with some of the other sins, there are things that people can't help. And sort of a dawning understanding of mental illness, mm. You know, like Bartleby the Scrivener, you know, the story of essentially, you know, just kind of like, oh, he's supposed to be the poster child for sloth, but actually it's a story about mental illness, you know.
Remind me, Bartleby the Scrivener.
Yeah, so it is I can't remember who wrote it. Bartleby the Scrivener. So it's the story about, told in Bartleby the Scrivener. It's by Melville, that's what I thought. So it's a story about, he's a scrivener. So this guy's working in office with this guy named Bartleby. And they have this kind of, you know, boss who's sort of like, rah, 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 rah. But over time, Bartleby, who'd been there forever and was kind of this, you know, a good employee at one time, just suddenly shuts down and is not working at all. And anytime anybody poses a question to him, he says, I prefer not to. And so it's just this kind of turning inward and kind of shutting down aspect. And it is often kind of mistaken for just the story of extreme laziness. But there's also this undercurrent of understanding like, oh no, like there's something, you know, something wrong with this guy. So it's really, I always joke that Bartleby is my life coach. but yeah, so he's always kind of held up as an example, just like the pardoner in The Pardoner's Tale in Chaucer.
So another literary sloth, this is going to be a bit of a long quote, but I really wanted to read C.S. Lewis's write-up of sloth in the Screwtape Letters. If you haven't read them, the Screwtape Letters are advice from a senior demon to his younger demon protege about how to corrupt souls, basically. And it's a little arch. It's British. It's ironic. So Americans may have trouble with it, but it's got some really good bits in it. So again, this is like a full page quote, but it's really good stuff. This was written in 1940, but it's so today that I just wanted to go through it. Okay. He's advising, Screwtape is advising his protege on how to deal with his patient. In this state of sloth, your patient will not omit, but will increasingly dislike his religious duties. He will think about them as little as possible as he feels decently can beforehand and forget about them as soon as possible when they are over. He will want his prayers to be unreal, for he will dread nothing so much as effective contact with the enemy. His aim will be let sleeping worms lie. You no longer need a good book, which he really likes, to keep him from his prayers or to his work or his sleep. A column of advertisements in yesterday's paper will do. You can make him waste his time not only in conversation he enjoys with people whom he likes, but in conversations with those who he cares nothing about on subjects that bore him. You can make him do nothing at all for long periods. You can keep him up late at night, not roistering, but staring at a dead fire in a cold room. All the healthy and outgoing activities which we want him to avoid can be inhibited and nothing given in return, so that at least he may say, as if one of my own patients said on his arrival down here, now I see that I spent most of my life in doing neither what I ought nor what I liked. The Christians describe the enemy as one without whom nothing is strong, and nothing is very strong, strong enough to steal away a man's best years, not in sweet sins, but a dreary flickering of the mind over it knows not what and knows not why, and the gratification of curiosities so feeble that the man is only half aware of them, in drumming of fingers and kicking of heels and whistling tunes that he does not like, or in the long, dim labyrinth of reveries that have not even lust or ambition to give them a relish, but which once chance association has started them, the creature is too weak and too fuddled to shake off.
Too fuddled.
Wow.
It just feels so today.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think that set me off on why I think doom scrolling is the ultimate manifestation of sloth in the 21st century.
It's true. There is this going back to Bartleby and thinking about like sloth as a sort of a you know, unhealthy, healthy reaction to trauma. And sort of like doom scrolling is like, it's a, this kind of like this, this relationship of trauma that you kind of passively resist by checking out, you know?
Yeah. Checking out of horror.
Right. Exactly. You know, I mean, and turning inward. But also that kind of moves to the whole idea of ennui, which is a more romantic version of this idea, because, you know, we move into the world of Sartre and Baudelaire and the romantics, where this just being weary of the world.
The New York Times article on sloth was called "Nearer My Couch to Thee."
So, you know, just kind of swooning in reaction to the horrors and the injustices of the world.
Is this in the same category as Weltschmerz?
I would say
that.
So.
I love that word. Weltschmerz is a mental affliction that afflicts the rich and privileged.
It's true. It's sort of like sloth is a sin of privilege. You know?
It can be. Like, I think part of it is it's letting yourself create barriers between you and what you need to do.
However, it is a sin of privilege, but it's also projected onto people you want to other. So colonialism justified often by describing the indigent natives of an area and, you know, making just like the regular sloths, like prodding them to work against their will to cure them of their laziness. And you also have a lot of anti-Semitism in depictions of sloth, specifically in illustrations of the seven deadly sins. Like, many times sloth is given more kind of Semitic features.
Oh, I hadn't noticed. Any pictures of that?
Uh-huh. Well, I mean, we've got the weird little dude that I have that actually has kind of stereotypical Irish face, which, again, another group considered slovenly and lazy. You know, a lot of Latin American people described as lazy, like anybody who you want to subjugate or other, for lack of a better word, I know there's a better word for that, you call them lazy. And, you know, you try to show that you are trying to make them more industrious.
Right.
Yeah. I'm coming to save you from your own
happiness.
Yeah.
Exactly. Like, I think in the Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, like Edward Gibbons talks about the Huns and sort of like pastoral cultures have this, I mean, they have a different, like, industriousness and sloth have different meanings in different cultures. And so pastoral cultures tend to have like more of this, you know, kind of layabout lifestyle. And so, you know, just thinking about, you know, lots of, and so this happens in depictions of Polynesian people. And, you know, so it's very interesting. Yes, I'll stop there.
we pinged on Chaucer a few number of times today, and there is a Chaucerian word that is, it's sloth adjacent, and it's a really interesting word. I've seen it spelled two different ways, but rawness or rawness, W-R-A-W-N-E-S-S or W-A-U-N-E-S-S. Anyway, it's a non-translatable word at this point, but it means perversity, contrariness, peevishness, and irritability.
Right.
Yeah. So I think this is the mental state that flows from sloth. And it's a good word.
This brings up something that I wanted to research but ran out of time, is the humors and their relationship to some of these. So would sloth be melancholic or would it be
phlegmatic? Probably a little column A, column B.
Mm-hmm. And also, I was wrong. It's The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire by Gibbons.
Oh, okay.
Anywho. But yeah, so because the Chaucerian, like the partner, I think he's described as kind of phlegmatic, right?
Does Chaucer invoke the humors much? I feel like I should know that question, but
I don't know if it's explicit, but anybody, you know, He's invoking them in that it's like it's a shorthand, like everybody knows what a phlegmatic type is.
Okay.
So he creates this character that represents the phlegmatic type or has those characteristics because his audience will know what that is.
Okay.
We have no answers.
I have no answers.
Only That's questions.
Too much black bile.
Would it surprise anyone to know that Sloth has 6 daughters?
Yes, yes. It would surprise me.
But every sin has had 6 or 7 daughters.
It's true. We talked about Greed's daughters.
I feel like every other sin would have 6 daughters, but Sloth would only have 4 because just
too much effort. Yeah. Too much effort. According to Aquinas and Pope Greg, the 6 daughters of Sloth are malice, spite, faint-heartedness, despair, sluggishness against the commandments, and wandering of the mind after unlawful things.
Wow. I understand some of those.
Whoa. So malice and spite are curiosity. So wrathful. Oh, I'm sorry. Curiosity.
No. Curiosity is a venial sin, which I think is a very bad church attitude.
don't question anything.
Don't question me. Just do what you're told.
I mean, spite isn't the same as anger. It's a sullen thing. Like it's snark.
It's pouting.
And, right? But yeah. it's definitely vindicative.
But it's not wrath. Wrath is like get out of your chair and do a thing. Spite is like I'm gonna like whisper at somebody behind their back and make them lose their job.
Or the silent treatment, which is passive. So passive aggression.
Yeah, I'd buy that.
But also, I mean, this goes back to the passive resistance idea of actively, like, passive aggressively not choosing God, right? You know, kind of turning your back, you know? With Jamin, you had a reaction
there. You're not wrong. But... Is Sloth passive aggressive? And why isn't passive aggressive just mild wrath? Why does wrath have to be active?
I understand because why. Pope
Gregory and
okay, Pope. Okay, listen. I'm not going to question it because curiosity is a sin.
Right. Well, a lot of this is like medieval categorization of things, and I think that they were kind of maybe you could have made other interpretations for sure, but like Sloth is. I mean, Sloth is a barrier to right action.
Yeah.
And wrath is a little more like feverish and intense.
You have to care about something to be angry about it. Like Sloth in the passive aggressive. Yeah. Apathy. Like it's apathy a very is like cold, Sloth
keyword.
It's a very cold thing rather than a thing of, you know, it is a complete lack of caring or lack of love. I think there's some descriptions of that. Because what is it? Indifferent? Well, there's some term that actually gets at, like, its actual meaning is lack of love.
Can I just briefly reference Dante's interpretations of love and the 7 deadly sins? Because it's kind of like on top of what we were just saying. Dante grouped the 7 deadlies into 3 categories. Love distorted, which is pride, envy, and anger. Love excessive, which is avarice, gluttony, and lust. And alone in his category is love defective, sloth.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay.
Love defective.
Mm-hmm. Yep. That's going to be broken love. That's my band name.
Broken love.
Beep. Okay. So let's go back to the daughters.
Okay.
The last and presumably youngest daughter, wandering of the mind after unlawful things.
Yes.
So yes. I want to posit some theories. I want to theorize some positions.
Okay.
Wandering of the mind after lawful things. Okay. Yes, no, question mark.
That's very close to meditation and reflection on God.
Okay. Clarity of the mind and focus after lawful things. Clarity of the mind and focus after unlawful things.
Maybe that's a different sin entirely. Then we start getting into lust.
I did a bad and I liked it.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. And so, again, sloth is an inactive sin in many ways. Focused mind is the enemy of sloth sometimes. take it to God or into like really bad parts unknown. But Sloth is kind of wandering around in a circle as well.
I like wandering around in a circle.
It's on the idea of like, I'll get to this with the Prince of Sloth, but the Prince of Sloth is an inventor and fills people's minds with fancies of how they'd solve their problems rather than letting them do the work of solving their problems.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Oh, Belphegor. Mm-hmm.
Belphegor, yeah.
This is the Belphegor. Okay. I have so many questions about Belphegor.
I have so many JPEGs of Belphegor.
And why is he such a bad guy? He just wants you to get rich.
Is he the toilet guy?
Sometimes, no. Yes. He is sometimes the toilet guy, he? Yes. let's push this off for now, though.
Okay.
Okay.
Can I say something about, can I give you a paradox?
Sure.
We've discussed a lot of paradoxes. Sloth is a sin of many contrasts.
Yes.
But so in this article that I read, actually called The Paradoxes of Sloth, there was Sloth, a paradoxical, intricate sin, which I think we've actually verified here today. But Marianna Nett, posits the idea that in Eden there was no work, there's no necessity for work or desire to work, and in order to obey God's law, man should have contemplated God's splendor in a state of eternal bliss. So no work was the natural state, right?
You sit back and
If that's the case, then the original sin is a proof of man's limitation. So he denied paradise, and that actually was the sin, to try to activate beyond paradise, where all you had to do was reflect on God and everything was taken care of and you were just in a state of constant bliss. That was the original sin. So initially, like, then what was not yet named Sloth did not necessarily wasn't a bad thing, because then industriousness kind of became like, as culture grew, not being industrious became a sin, when actually potentially that's the natural state, is just living in bliss and not worrying about anything because God's going to take care of it all, which a lot of evangelicals will tell you is what we're supposed to do too.
I think slapping any label of sin on top of the Garden of Eden story is a little bit late Christian in some ways. Mm-hmm. Like the narrative over and over and again in the Bible is that we outgrow and we set our sights high and move beyond it and get scattered over and over again. It's like the Genesis stories are almost always diaspora stories. So
it's true.
We'd have to grow up and leave the garden inevitably. That's just the nature of humans. So to say, I mean, I think that probably being in the garden and being unaware of like the challenges that God will put in front of us and growing up towards God is simultaneously like sloth and bliss at the same time. Like it's both.
Right.
But it's a doomed state. Like that's part of the story is let's move on. There's no staying here. We got to move forward.
Yeah. And I mean, this kind of backs up also the idea of pride being the original sin too. Trying to look for something beyond what has been given to you because you believe that you can do that and that you can leave without the support or God allowing you to leave, I suppose. Right. I don't know. I don't know where I was going with that.
So let's take some time out to discuss one of the big celebrities associated with Sloth, and that is Belphegor, the demon of Sloth. As identified in the Lantern of Light, was he Belphegor, the demon of Sloth in Lantern of Light?
Nobody knows. There's absolutely no way of finding out. It's impossible.
I'm unplugging the internet from downstairs.
No, the Lantern of Light had Abaddon as the demon of Sloth, and Binsfeld has Belphegor as the demon of Sloth.
That's why I got confused. Abaddon had nothing to do with any of this.
Abaddon is the like demon of Sheol and the abyss.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or angel of same. So like, you know, in the quiet of death, he might actually be like a slothy sort of creature. But I guess Binsfeld wanted a more active approach to things and sloth in particular. So he went with Belphegor. And I like Belphegor a lot. He's got a lot of color associated with him. For one thing, Belphegor may have the alternate identity of Chemosh, C-H-E-M-O-S-H. Oh,
yes. Uh-huh.
Yeah. And that is, among other things, the avatar, the Baal-ish figure that Solomon sacrificed to, which created 400 years of Baal conflation in the Israelite faith, but also right. kind of might have been why Solomon was like no longer like accepted as the king, because he lost his magical powers because of Baal worship. So Chemosh is a fairly major Baal, and Belphegor actually comes from Baal of Peor Pass, or mm-hmm. the Peor Gap. Like Peor was like big mountains with a little valley between them.
Is that where there was like evidence of child sacrifice? Or do we talked about that at some point?
Everybody did that. I think but on that, one of Belphegor's names is Chemosh Malik. So okay. tied to Moloch.
I was going
to
say, is there an MLK in there?
There is an MLK in there, yeah. Which is both messenger king and also associated with that particularly burning demon of child sacrifice. So there's okay. a connection. There's a connection. But he's, among other things, the demon of invention, which is, I think, interesting. It's why he kind of picked up the sloth avatar idea. In particular, he likes to tempt people towards inventions to make them rich. And sometimes that makes them fantasize about their riches rather than like actually doing the hard work to get the riches done. So mm-hmm. whether he's a demon or a daemon is kind of your point of view at that particular point in time.
He doesn't sound like a bad guy. He just wants you to be happy.
Right. Temptation is a thing that demons do. And offering happiness is a thing that demons do. So this is kind of a 1-2 punch for him.
Because they understand humans.
Yeah.
They get us, demons.
So Peor also means gap. And by gap, that means, first off, it could mean your mouth and the babbling that you're doing there. Yeah, but that's not the only option for what the gap might mean. Okay. And so Belphegor has, over the years, picked up a lot of butt associations. And a lot of these are tied. They're kind of part of the like Israelite Jewish.
Oh, that's the other option.
That's where the 8-year-old boy took over writing the grimoire.
Yes, yeah, exactly. So the some of the Jewish demonizations of this, a lot of energy was spent fighting Baal, which mm-hmm. is kind of like brothers fighting each other, because like Baal was part of the pantheon until 400 AD or BC or so. So as they're pushing away from that version of Baal, they start associating him with like butt stuff, and he start like, first off, it's like honoring Belphegor is involves dropping trouser, and I don't know if that means you're flashing him or mooning him, but both are probably options. And then poop is like, some rabbi says poop is the way to celebrate Belphegor and to honor him, so that's part of all the rituals. And so then you get the image from Dictionary Infernal of Belphegor being a weird little guy sitting on a toilet all the time. And he's kind of like, it's hard to disassociate modern Belphegor from butt stuff and poop, which is a little dismaying. He was probably a fertility god originally, and like is associated with Prepus on mm-hmm. some levels. And Baal is a fertility god too. So this kind of fades into the idea of like weird sexual ritual, which the Jewish people were not very comfortable with, and also kind of feeds into slightly perverse aspects and uncleanliness, which then again leads to Belphegor as the poop demon. Mm-hmm. He's the god.
And for the record, the toilet he's on is a fancy gizmo Japanese, like 27 button bidet.
I was going to say it's a mm-hmm. modernish.
Yeah.
Toilet.
One assumes so.
This is going to be mm-hmm. a fancy toilet.
He is the principal god of the Moabites. I mean, this is Belphegor is a high god. He is like a chief, an El, a Yahweh level god. But he's the chief god of the Moabites, who are the people that are kind of just southeast of Israel. Mm-hmm. And they are the people that came from that one time Noah's daughters got Noah drunk and then did a thing.
Oh, yeah.
Unfortunately, the region that the Israelites first majorly encountered the Baal people, the Moabites, was the region of Shittim. S-H-I-T-T-M.
Again, the eight-year-old boy.
Very, very much so.
It wasn't funny until the Middle Ages.
It wasn't. And so they encountered the daughters of Shittim, who they say are kind of prostitutes and such. And those people lead Israel into a state of obviously false happiness. And they had to pull themselves out of that. So there's kind of this nebulous time of Belphegor not being that bad and maybe like majorly occupying a lot of Israel's time before they started redefining themselves. The Old Testament is largely Israel defining itself in a literary context. And so there's a lot of like, and then we stopped doing that sort of moments there. And this is one of them.
Oh, okay.
That's Belphegor.
Can I say that after 3 years, I'm like realizing like, oh my gosh, I've actually learned some stuff. And I'm like, yes, know that guy.
But Belphegor Shemash he gets a lot of mentions in the Bible, and that's kind of neat. That's actually fairly rare.
Yeah. So he's probably, who's the most mentioned? Would it be Beelzebub?
No. Well, Satan probably gets Belial.
Not really mentioned.
Gets a lot of mentions. Yeah. Well, Belial's intertestamental. Beelzebub, Asmodeus, and I'm not going to say Satan because that's a really weird concept.
Yeah.
Are probably like top two. Beelzebub is pretty high. Jesus actually, there's a cute line where someone says, I hear you're casting out people in the name of Beelzebub. And Jesus turns to the people accusing him and says, well, who would you cast them out in the name of?
Oh, yeah. We talked about that story. Yeah. I remember. I'm learning.
It's Jesus the magician type stuff.
Now I need an object lesson explaining everything I've learned.
And poop.
But if we put our colored dye into the poop...
Oh dear. Oh dear. It's come to this.
Oh no. Let's move on.
Okay. So are there any famous slots? I tried to look for famous slots and I just kept getting famous slots, like actual animals that are famous.
I don't think you tried hard enough.
I did find a website of slots that look like famous people though. So I came pretty close.
Well, I would encourage you to Google for world's laziest person.
Okay.
And I got two good stories Googling for that. One of them is short, like this guy's biography is very short, as is appropriate to the subject matter. Englishman Jeremiah Carleton was the heir to a large fortune at age 19, went to bed and stayed there for 70 years because he wanted to.
Oh my gosh.
And then he died in bed at age 89.
So what did he do the whole time?
Lied in bed and used his fortune to do that.
So people brought him food. Did he ever did he get bed sores?
I don't know. He had servants to flip him over, and staying in bed doesn't mean you aren't doing jumping jacks necessarily. But he didn't like do much with his life after becoming heir to a large fortune.
Okay. I feel like this is the Salvation Army lady would have a lot to say about this.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I have a much more interesting and, decorated sloth to discuss.
But so she would claim that God gave him all that money. So he needed to do something with it besides lay about all day.
He did give it to his 40 servants to some degree.
I guess you're right, but still.
That's a lot of servants. Like that's a one man army. Yeah.
And I can't imagine that they weren't, you know, I don't know. It might be a pretty, pretty easy gig.
Yeah. You know, flip him over every 4 hours or so.
Yeah.
Probably had to converse with him, which would be really boring because like.
So what'd you do today?
Yeah.
Somebody flipped me over. I was on this side and now I'm on that side.
One of the more famous sloths of the last century is also is far more interesting in his slothfulness and approach to it. That is Stephen James Napier Tennant.
Ooh. Who
died as recently as 1987, so a fairly recent one. He's part of the like glitterati of like 20s Britain. The Bright Young Things was his social group. There's like movies about them, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a name to conjure with. And they were just like this group of cheerful young people that really just captivated the journalists and the period people of the period with their, you know, kind of eccentric stuff. They'd throw fancy dress parties and go on treasure hunts throughout town and drink and drink and drink and drink and drink and other things.
So were they in any way associated like the Hellfire Clubs?
I feel like they were.
But that was too early. Hellfire Clubs are too early.
Yeah, but I think they kind of picked up the spirit of like cheerful abandon.
Yeah.
They weren't really transgressive so much. They were just weird. They were LARPers.
Dandies.
What?
Kind of dandyish.
Yeah. Very much that. So the brightest of the Bright Young Things was Tennant, who was, he was kind of at the center of everything. He was a fairly eccentric person, had the money to do that. Among his like many things, so his biographer, Philip Hoare, H-O-A-R-E, I don't know how you say that in British, he was not kind, but he wrote like a 450-page bio of this guy. So
wow.
He's alternately kind of loving and snarky about him, but I think that maybe Tennant's sense of humor would have supported that. He describes Tennant as being like one of the last professional beauties. To call Stephen affected, oh, this is another person, would be like calling an acrobat a show-off. Or to call a golden peasant bulger, but he was just a lot of wacky. But he just covered himself in perfume and put gold dust in his wigs and hairdos and makes himself up all over the place. His major hobbies seem to be like dressing up and reading about himself in the papers. He was very like kind of. Everything was like too much for him. Like he would see a flower and be in a paroxysm of overmuch and had to have a sit down. And like when he was going to go for a ride with his friends, he decided to, he needed to be blindfolded. So he wasn't just overwhelmed by the sensations of the countryside going past. So very artistic temperament. He was a writer, of course. But was always trying to start and or finish his novel, which was called Lascar, A Story You Must Forget.
Yes.
And is generally believed that he spent the last 17 years of his life in bed. That is not quite accurate because he did travel and make some new friends, but he did like spend a lot of the rest of his life as a recluse. And a lot of that time kind of in an idle state, gaining weight. I think he might have coined the phrase, well, there's more of me to love. He was quite gay. He had his lover that was like his main, you know, confidant and go back and forth with, who's now I totally forget at this point.
Is it Siegfried Sassoon?
Sassoon. Yeah. Yes. That's a great name. I would love
it. Is.
Yeah.
In his little military dress with the hat.
Mm-hmm.
He was awfully weird, and his biographer said gay bashers didn't stand a chance with Stephen. He diffused them by being so charming. It's hard to understand the effect Stephen had when he came back into the room. You'd have colonels, for example, taken aback, but in the next minute, Stephen would send them to go get his nail file. And, as I said, Hoare called him England's greatest work of non-performance art.
Oh my God! I was just looking at the Bright Young Things, and I didn't know that Evelyn Waugh was one of them too. There's several people that I recognized in that group.
Oh, yeah. I was looking through the list and I don't have the British literature connections that you do to recognize them all.
I need to spend more time with this. This sounds fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah. I read about him in the Big Book of Weirdos, which is like factoid books, like little graphic novelizations of various strange people throughout history.
What? Why have I not heard about this?
Oh, they're great books. There's one like the Big Book of Death and the Big Book of Weirdos and the Big Book of Martyrs and the Big Book of Bad and the Big Book of the 70s. They're all fun reading. And it's like some of the best graphic novelists or illustrators of that period doing like little short blurbs on historical and literary characters. It's fun. Right. It's fun stuff.
The Big Book. Okay. So there's kind of, I don't know, like there's sort of a line from there's a lot of Oscar Wilde in this as well. But Oscar Wilde was way more active, you know, but still this kind of jejune.
Yeah, I mean, clearly, like, snappy wit was a thing.
Uh-huh.
God, the level of, like, weird gay energy off of this guy.
Yeah. WGE.
Yeah. Oh, and connection. Charlotte had leopard print, and Bennett wore leopard print pajamas.
Oh.
Full circle.
Can I just say
briefly, that's how circles work.
Yes.
It's true. Now, I could say this with full confidence that nobody who lives in Lake Jackson will ever listen to this podcast, but every woman in Lake Jackson wears some kind of animal print. Like, it's like wildly popular in Lake Jackson, Texas.
Is there some deeper symbolism there, or is it just what's done?
It's a place where there's a lot of word art, a lot of, like, a variety of different, you know, crosses. Like, you can buy all kinds of crosses that have, like, leopard print, studs, you know, just kind of cross art as well.
Ugh.
And lots of, you know, wine o'clock sort of decorated wine glasses, but lots and lots of animal prints.
Hmm.
Yeah. Well, if you go into boutiques, tons and tons of kind of sort of, yeah, like, I don't know.
There's
East Texas there. Hobo
sheep.
Animal print, Stevie Nicksy stuff. I don't even know how to describe it. Camo, animal print, and Stevie Nicks. You just kind of put it in a blender and you got Lake Jackson.
Are we done then?
I think we are. I'm starting to talk about. Yes. Uh-huh.
Okay. So I feel like we've been keeping people away from God all night, possibly for the last 3 years, but specifically all night. And maybe want to bring this one to a close.
I guess.
Are your thoughts wandering, having done the thing you've done?
Yes, wandering illegally. No, what is it? I don't remember the word anymore. I forget.
I feel like we should have recorded this in bed.
I would have looked this up, but I just honestly can't be arsed.
Wandering of the mind after unlawful things.
Is it unlawful to promote apostasy?
Yes.
Oh.
I mean, it depends on your set of laws, but it has been.
Wait, what's in some that over there?
Yes. So what are we tackling next time? Is next time envy, we think?
Yeah.
Yes.
The local green-eyed
actually a monster of sloth.
Because I suffer the sin of envy.
Okay. Well, I'm looking forward to that.
I'm looking forward to it more.
Well, I'm looking forward to it the most.
Now you're sounding angry, and that's not next week. But in the meantime, dear listeners, we wish you the best, and we'll see you in hell.
Yay!
This podcast is copyright 2023 by The Dispatchist and is Creative Commons. You're welcome to reuse with attribution. Look for us on your favorite podcast app. Say hi to us on Twitter or Gmail at The Dispatchist, no spaces. Check out our website, dispatch.ist, for episodes, show notes, and a variety of hellish resources.